Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello, and welcome back to the program that helps you improve your American English. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. We come to you 7 days a week with interesting stories from around the world. We present them in a way that is easy to understand. We speak a little slower than normal, and we use fewer and easier words. Today, we have some important information about a possible new treatment for AIDS. Then, in about 5 minutes, we will tell you about a woman who has won a big prize for her work in preventing too many fish from being caught in the ocean. Let's get started with part one. Researchers in the United States are calling it a big deal. Next year, human tests could lead to a new treatment for AIDS. It is being called an innovative and creative treatment. It changes the DNA of cells to make them HIV fighters. The treatment has protected monkeys from a primate type of the immune disorder. Anna Mateo brings the news to Learning English.
Researchers in the United States are changing healthy muscle cells to make them produce genetic information that could possibly neutralize HIV, the virus that causes AIDS in humans. Scientists at Scripps Research Institute in Jupiter, Florida, tested the treatment on a type of monkey. The immune systems of these monkeys were repeatedly exposed to simian immunodeficiency virus, the primate version of HIV. The animals never became infected after a treatment to change the muscle cells. Michael Farzan is the lead researcher on the project. He and his team administered the virus to the monkeys in increasing amounts. They started with a dose that easily passes SIV to the untreated monkeys in the control group. But the treated monkeys remained uninfected. Then the scientists doubled the dose for each re-exposure to the virus. Mr. Farzan said even monkeys that received 16 times the usual dose were protected. They did not get infected with SIV.
We continue to administer the virus, doubling the dose each time. We've now gone to with six doses that were capable of infecting control animals, we've gone to 16 times that.
Traditional vaccines train the immune system to recognize and destroy disease. But experimental AIDS vaccines fail at this because the virus is always mutating or changing to avoid destruction. HIV and SIV are both able to do this because of a surface protein that mutates to avoid the body's immune system. Mr. Farzan says this new drug treatment is based on tricking HIV. The drug tricks HIV into exposing this important viral surface protein. The experimental compound attaches to the part of the virus that is always mutating to avoid the immune system. Once attached, a second protein makes the virus self-destruct. The virus never has a chance to infect cells.
Because HIV is sort of fooled into thinking that it's binding the cell, it undergoes the changes that it would normally do when it's ready to enter a cell. And those changes, if it's not near a cell, inactivate the virus.
The muscle cells continually produce cells that fool the virus into self-destruction. Mr. Farzan says the compound has the potential both to protect against infection with HIV and to fight the virus in infected people. The team wants to begin testing human patients who are not able to take antiretroviral drugs. The researchers published their findings in the journal Nature. According to the World Health Organization, almost 78 million people have been infected with the HIV virus. About 39 million people have died of HIV. In 2013 alone, 35 million people were living with HIV or AIDS, and 1.5 million died from AIDS. The virus still affects sub-Saharan Africa more severely than any other part of the world. Nearly one in every 20 adults there is living with HIV. This represents almost 71% of the people living with HIV worldwide. I'm Anna Mateo.
You are listening to VOA, the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. A leading American supporter of a method to prevent overfishing has won a major environmental prize. Jane Lubchenco served as head of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration between 2009 and 2013. Bob Doty tells us about her and the award.
Ms. Lubchenco supported programs known as Catch Shares when she led the administration, also known as NOAA. Catch Shares set maximum levels, or the largest amount of fish that can be caught in a given area. Then the legally permitted catch is divided among fishermen. Supporters say Catch Shares stop what they call a race to the bottom. In other words, fishermen try to catch as much as possible without considering the future of the fish population. With catch shares, fishermen's takes increase as the population recovers and grows. Jane Lubchenco credits these programs with strengthening fish populations in the United States.
From 2000 to 2013, we went from having 92 overfished stocks to 40, and we went from having zero rebuilt stocks to 34. It gives us incredible hope that we can replicate those successes elsewhere and really end overfishing at the global scale.
Critics say catch shares can force smaller fishermen out of the market. They say catch share programs also raise barriers to people just getting started in the industry. 17 U.S. fisheries are in catch share programs, and more are in development. Ms. Lubchenco will share the $200,000 Tyler Prize for Environmental Achievement with Madhav Godgill of Goa University in India. Mr. Godgill was recognized for involving local communities in environmental protection. I'm Bob Doty.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. Stay with us. This is VOA, the Voice of America.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Environment and Science Report. A new satellite is traveling 1.5 million kilometers over a 110-day period to enter an orbit of the sun. It is called Discover, the Deep Space Climate Observatory. It will replace a satellite that has been observing space weather. Discover will begin its work during the worst of the 11-year-long solar cycle. This is a time when extreme weather on the sun can have the greatest effect on planet Earth. Discover will gather information about a continuing flow of particles from the sun. We are protected from these particles by the Earth's magnetic field and atmosphere, but we are not fully protected from what scientists call coronal mass ejections. These are strong storms that can happen on the sun's surface. Thomas Berger is the director of the Space Weather Prediction Center at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA. He says these ejections are much more dangerous than solar particles. He says the coronal mass ejections are extremely large magnetic clouds that are expelled from the sun at extremely high speeds. He says when they impact Earth, it is like a hurricane impacting Earth in terms of space weather. Violent space weather can make electric systems stop working. It can block satellite signals to Earth. It can interfere with radio signals and air travel. Mr. Berger says we cannot stop the ejections from affecting us, but we can prepare for them if we know when they will happen. When the Discover satellite records an ejection, it will release a warning. Mr. Berger says the warning will provide NOAA about 15 to 60 minutes to let people know that a very strong storm is coming in to the Earth. He says that is enough time for power grid operators to take protective action. He says it is also enough time for workers to place satellites on a safe operating method if necessary. Mr. Berger says scientists would like even more time, of course. He says researchers are developing instruments that will give an earlier warning. The warnings from Discover will be for the whole planet. But Mr. Berger says a new system may be able to give more targeted warnings. He says future models will be able to tell exactly what part of the world will be more at risk from a solar storm. That means that, for the first time, humans will get both a warning that a magnetic storm is heading towards Earth and information about where it is likely to hit. And that's the VOA Learning English Environment and Science Report. For more environment, science, and agriculture reports, go to our website, learningenglish.com. VOANews.com. I'm Marcia James.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In 1914, Europe exploded into the First World War. It was a war no nation really wanted, but no nation seemed able to stop it. The assassination of Austria's Archduke Franz Ferdinand in the city of Sarajevo was the spark that set off the explosion. This week in our series, Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant tell about the war and how it affected the United States under President Woodrow Wilson.
The Austrian Archduke was murdered by Serbian nationalists. They opposed Austrian control of their homeland. After the assassination, Austria declared war on Serbia. One of Serbia's allies was Russia. Russia agreed to help Serbia in any war against Austria. Austria had allies, too. The most important was Germany. Germany wanted Russia to stay out of the war. When Russia refused, Germany declared war on Russia. Then Germany declared war on Russia's close ally, France. Britain entered the war a few days later, when Germany violated the neutrality of Belgium.
One nation after another entered the conflict to protect its friends or to honor its treaties. Within a week, most of Europe was at war. On one side were the Central Powers, Germany and Austria-Hungary. On the other side were the Triple Entente allies, France, Britain, and Russia. Many other nations took sides. Bulgaria and Turkey joined the Central Powers. Italy, Romania, Portugal, and Greece joined the Allies.
The United States hoped to stay out of the war. President Wilson immediately declared American neutrality. He said, "It is a war with which we have nothing to do, whose causes cannot touch us." Most Americans agreed with President Wilson. They did not want to get involved in the fighting. However, many found it difficult to remain neutral in their hearts. Some Americans had family roots in Germany. They supported the Central Powers. A greater number of Americans had family roots in Britain or France. They supported the Allies. Yet the official American policy was neutrality. The United States planned to continue to trade with both sides.
Germany and Austria expected a quick victory in the war. They were caught between two powerful enemies, Russia and France. But German military leaders were not worried. They had a battle plan they were sure would succeed. The German generals planned to strike quickly at France with most of the German army. They expected to defeat France in a short time and then turn to fight Russia. In this way, the German army would not have to fight both enemies at the same time.
At first, the plan worked. 2 million German soldiers swept across Belgium and into France. They rushed forward toward Paris, hoping for a fast victory. But the German commanders made a mistake. They pushed their men too fast. When British and French forces struck back outside Paris, the tired and worn German soldiers could not hold their positions. The battle was fierce and unbelievably bloody. In the end, the Germans were forced to withdraw. The German withdrawal gave the Allies time to prepare strong defenses. There was no chance now for a quick German victory. Instead, it would be a long war, with Germany and Austria facing enemies on two sides. Britain and France were on the west, Russia was on the east.
The Allies took immediate steps to reduce Germany's trade with the rest of the world. The British Navy began seizing war supplies found on neutral ships sailing toward German ports. It then expanded its efforts to block food exports to Germany. The blockade by Britain and the other Allies was very successful. Germany faced possible starvation. Its navy was not strong enough to break the blockade with surface ships. Its only hope was to break the blockade with another naval weapon, submarines. Germany announced that it would use its submarines to sink any ship that came near the coast of Britain. The threat included ships from neutral nations that tried to continue trading with the Allies.
The United States and other neutral nations immediately protested the German announcement. They said it was a clear violation of international law. When a German submarine sank a British ship in the Irish Sea, one of the victims was an American citizen. A few weeks later, an American oil ship was damaged during a sea battle between British Navy ships and a German submarine. Then came the most serious incident of all. It involved a British passenger ship called the Lusitania. The Lusitania was sailing from New York City to Britain when it was attacked by a German submarine. The Lusitania sank in 18 minutes. 1,200 persons were killed. 129 were Americans.
The sinking of the Lusitania shocked and horrified the American people. They called it mass murder. They turned against Germany. President Wilson warned that he might declare war on Germany if Germany continued to sink civilian ships. Germany did not want war with the United States. It already faced a strong fight against the European allies. It promised not to sink any more civilian ships without warning, and it offered regrets for the Lusitania incident.
President Wilson accepted Germany's apology. Like most Americans, he hoped to stay out of the bloody European struggle. And he also knew that the record of the Allies was not completely clean. For example, he was troubled by reports of mass hunger in Germany. He and other Americans felt the British food blockade was cruel. They also were shocked by the way British forces brutally crushed a rebellion in Ireland at the time. Most of all, the American people were sickened by reports of what was happening on the battlefields of Europe. The armies were using poison gas and other terrible weapons. Soldiers on both sides were dying by the millions. The war had become a bloodbath.
The United States had a presidential election in 1916. President Wilson won the nomination of the Democratic Party to seek re-election. Democrats around the country shouted their support with these words, "He kept us out of war." Wilson himself did not like the words. He felt it raised false hopes. But people continued to say it because they did not want war.
The Republican Party nominated Supreme Court Justice Charles Evans Hughes as its candidate for president. Hughes was a moderate Republican. He supported a number of social reforms. Like Wilson, Hughes promised to keep the United States neutral. However, one of his supporters was former President Theodore Roosevelt, and Roosevelt called for strong American policies that could lead to war. Roosevelt's words led many Americans to see Wilson as the candidate of peace, and Hughes as the candidate of war.
Voting in the presidential election was very close. At first, it seemed Hughes had won. He went to bed on election night, believing he would be America's next president. But voting results later that night confirmed Wilson as the winner. The election was so close, the Republicans did not accept defeat for 2 weeks. Woodrow Wilson had won another term. During that term, he would find it increasingly difficult to honor the words of the campaign, "He kept us out of war." Finally, he would find it impossible. The United States entered World War I while Woodrow Wilson was president. That will be our story next week.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and images at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.